Gata on opening the sutra.
Do I need to do anything? So good morning once again. So you see, we said last night that everyone's beginners. We're starting a new session. We're doing things we haven't done sometimes ever, people. And that's part of the adventure. That's part of our practice. To stay with that beginner's mind and remain open to whatever arises and respond to the situation accordingly. There's no right way or wrong way of doing anything. So whatever it is, it is. So today, this is 50 years ago today, we know what happened in Portugal. Too bad we don't have carnations on our altar. We know what happened. I don't know how many people here, probably not so many, remember that day from your own experience. Sorry, yeah, right. So there, yeah, some of you were not born, some of you may have been very small. Some of you I've talked at length with about what you were doing that day, and what your family, what was happening in your families, and or what your parents have told you if you weren't born, and things like that. And I even saw, I just looked at some headlines this morning, the French and American press, and in the French sports newspaper, L'Équipe, there was an article which I didn't read, but I saw the headline, something about how the Carnation Revolution and football, and how that changed, how it changed football in Portugal, and how football is today the place where all the different social classes meet. And I don't know if they mean by all of the children play it from all the different social classes, or all the different social classes are supporters of football. I know everyone is not a supporter of football, but within the supporters there's all the different classes. And so it was some academic guy who wrote a book, a Portuguese guy who wrote a book that the article was talking about. So even football was affected by the Carnation Revolution. And we, any revolution, you know, another one that is quite extraordinary, which the outcome was very different, was when the Berlin Wall fell. Which you certainly have an experience of, yeah. Extraordinary in the sense that no one saw it coming. It had you know, like the situation in Portugal. It had been in place for 50 years, 40 years, almost 40 years, and that was the status quo. That's just what it was. I myself am a child of the Cold War, so I grew up and there was just, that's just what it was. The East Bloc, the West Bloc. Of course, I was full of American propaganda about the, you know, horrible, the Red Scare and the Reds and the Russians and all this, but suddenly, like here with, you know, suddenly there were carnations. No one died in the Carnation Revolution, right? I think there were no...
A few people left.
Okay.
Four.
So think of that. In a population of 10 million, or what was it at the time? I don't know what it was. Think of it, and see, think of some of the really bloody, you know, the French Revolution, everybody's heads got cut off. The American Revolution, it was, you know, fighting against the British, people killing each other. Various other revolutions are very violent. It just so happens that this one, flowers, or that's the flowers who kind of symbolize it. And I know it's not as simple as I'm making it sound. However, there is truth to the fact that no one saw it coming in the way that when it came and how it came. Same with the Berlin Wall coming down. There were, you know, there was rumblings before, and it actually was almost like a misunderstanding with the Berlin Wall, that some guy from the East German Politburo had said, yes, East Germans will all be able to go to West Germany freely. It will be possible immediately or something. He didn't mean what he said. It was kind of awkward the way that he said it. But so some guard at the gate and all these people were pressing to it. So everyone went to the border and all these people were trying to get through. So the guard just said, okay, well, they said we could open it. So he opened it and then there was no turning back. And I'm also simplifying it a bit, but those are the basic facts. So how does that relate to... So these are political and social revolutions, revolts. And we have heroes that are related to that. We venerate the people who were involved in these social and political revolutions, whether it's Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, Martin Luther King in the United States. I don't know who your heroes are around this revolution exactly. You know, the one we always hear about is Mario Suarez, but I'm sure he was not the hero. What? Okay. So, you know, and they have these heroes. However, before they were heroes, they, you know, took a risk and were proclaiming something that was marginal, that was not part of the status quo. Some of them suffered greatly. I don't know if that captain did, but some of them, you know, in Portugal, lots of people went into exile. France is full of Portuguese people who, a lot of them, some came for economic reasons, but some were political exiles. And a lot of other European countries too, right? They left because they did not accept the status quo, whether it was economic, social, cultural, political, whatever. They did not accept the status quo. So how does that relate to our practice? This practice, which is a revolution of the mind, a revolution of the heart. The very fact that you're sitting here means you don't accept the status quo. The status quo of greed, anger, and ignorance. To some degree, otherwise you would not be sitting here. The status quo of your own unawakened mind that is actually what is oppressing you, what is imprisoning you. So you're in this prison of your mind, of your ignorance, not seeing who you truly are, not seeing the true nature of things. So we could say that, you know, as a nation, Portugal was oppressed by this, you know, institutional and established ignorance. And it was very hard to go against that because that became the status quo. And the same thing happens within ourselves, right? We're so familiar with this status quo of judging, separating, grasping, clinging, rejecting, dividing and conquering, whether it's within our own selves and things we don't like about ourselves or things that we want for ourselves. So we want to attain, we want to accomplish, we want to become famous, we want to become rich, we want to become someone else, we want to become smarter, we want to become healthier, we want to be younger. When we're a child, we want to be older, and then when we're grown up, we want to be younger. Always something else. So all of this we're so familiar with. And we miss, therefore, what is our basic, perfect, limitless true nature that does not need to have anything else. That does not doesn't. There is nothing to have, in fact. I'm just looking at my notes so I don't forget something. You know, this practice of ours is a deep, it's deeply entrenched lineage of awakening. So it goes back 2,500 years to the original person who sat down and woke up to, let's see, I wrote some notes about what we could say he woke up to, you know. He was like all of us, you know. He was living in a situation, he happened to be living in great comfort and wealth compared to those around him. His father was in a leadership position, a position of power and resources that others didn't have. And of course, his father wanted to protect his child, as any parent wants to do. So cut him off from anything that might threaten this comforting existence. But it was a prison. So we can hear echoes in ourselves, you know, so we cut ourselves off from anything that might threaten our, what we think of as our privileged existence. So we don't want to see homeless people, we don't want to see people who have drug addictions, we don't want to see sick people, we don't want to deal with death, we don't want people who don't look like us. I think it was in a talk the other night that I said something about, you know, the Roman Empire fell because the barbarians entered Rome and sacked the city, right? Well, so who were the barbarians? Actually, the barbarians were just everybody who weren't Roman. It's kind of hard to define who these barbarians were, right? But the basic line was they weren't Roman. And, have we learned anything since the year 410, you know? Because still the barbarians are the people who are not us, as long as we fail to see that they are us and we are them, that we're not different. Okay, they look different, speak a different language, they have a different kind of money, they maybe have different values, they certainly have different gods and rituals and practices, they eat different food, all of that, of course. But that's just the forms, right? When we don't see our true nature, when we're then we're in this prison of form and concept that limits us in such a exaggerated way. Because, of course, our life is limited. The life of this body, right? This vehicle is limited. That's true. But the essence of being is not limited. The essence of who you truly are is not limited. And we become attached to just this body form and all the other body forms, and we miss then this limitless true nature of all things, our true self, who you truly are. And then, of course, then the barbarians, we don't want them. And even to the extent of, so if we take, you know, any of the world conflicts that we're involved with today, let's just pick one that's in everybody's mind, the Israel-Palestine issue. So, you know, at heart, the Jewish faith and the Islamic faith are not about what is being done in their name. Those spiritual practices are not about that. However, so just to take the Israeli side, to protect the Zionist view, which is, you know, the Holy Land and the Jewish people returning and flourishing in the Holy Land, to protect that very basic, which was actually a basic idea of peace and freedom for all. It was not just for the Jewish people. It was for everyone to be free and at peace. So in order to protect that, it has become so caught by the ignorance of the prison of ignorance that anything justifies protecting that. And the same goes for the opposite. So we could say that, you know, for the Islamic fundamentalists, who their practice, their belief, their spiritual path as well is not about violence, about killing everybody who doesn't look like them. That in order to justify anything justifies that. So attacking people in their homes and murdering and rape and whatever, taking hostages, all of that is justified to protect the spiritual path. So we see very clearly what happens when we don't wake up, when we function. It's like sleepwalking, or it's like functioning in a dream. I had some dream last night. I can't remember what it was, but something, you know, something was going on, and I feel like I was like trying to tell someone to stop doing something. I don't know what it was. And when I woke up, I thought that maybe I had actually said that. So I don't know if anyone in my hall room over there heard that and woke up. I don't know. In the middle of the night. Maybe I didn't. I don't know. But so when you wake up from the dream, you see, of course it wasn't true. Of course. Of course it was just a dream. It's so clear. And it doesn't matter how long that dream lasted or how many times you've had, you know, sometimes we have dreams that we repeat over and over again. For years even, we can have this repetitive dream, recurring dream. It doesn't matter how real it seemed and how much made sense it made when you were asleep, how much you screamed or laughed or cried or whatever it was. When you wake up, it's just so clear that it was not that. It's so clear. Even if you kind of think, oh, wow. For a minute, you think, wow, did that really happen? Or then you see someone you dreamed about, you see them during the day, and you're like, oh, wow, I was with that person during the night, you know? And yet you know you weren't. You know it's fiction. Well, that's the same thing that happens on this path of awakening. When you wake up and you truly see who you truly are, the true nature of things, it's exactly like when you wake up from a dream. It's like, what? course. It's so clear. Of course. And nothing will ever be the same again. It doesn't mean, however, that, so we say, okay, Portugal woke up from their 50-year bad dream and overthrew the oppressors. Well, everything wasn't all happy and gay after that, right? You know, a lot of things happened that were cause for great suffering for some, and fighting and struggle, and a lot of things happened after that. And yet everyone, although maybe it's changing now, you know, I realize the latest elections in Portugal lead us to believe that maybe people have forgotten, but there is a realization that what happened during those 50 years was completely crazy, in a sense. As the example I gave with the Berlin Wall falling and then the collapse of the East Bloc and the Soviet Empire, not everything was not perfect and great and rosy about that either. And we're kind of in the situation we are in today because of how things unfolded after that. Because, you know, the other side didn't wake up and was triumphant and then convinced everyone to follow in the, you know, the rampant capitalist world that is now oppressing us all. But it's not, doesn't mean it's perfect, right? That's within the social and political, cultural realm. In our spiritual path of awakening and liberation, the difference is that we see the root cause of it all. When we awaken to who we truly are, we see what is causing all of the suffering, all of the pain, all of the struggle that we have, all of the arguments and the stealing and lying and cheating and abusing. We see what the root of that is. And the root of that is the basic ignorance of not seeing who we truly are. This was what the Buddha's fundamental, that's what happened to him when he failed in the other practices he had tried. He still was suffering. So he just sat down and did what we do. He said, I'm just going to sit here and see what happens. Of course, just sitting there and see what happens, he had this intention of this question, because the question, that's why our koan practice in this lineage is so important, because the questioning is the key that opens the door to the prison. The key that allows us to open our minds and open our heart. So the Buddha had this questioning. What is the root of the suffering? Why am I suffering? Why is everyone suffering? What is it? And yet he said, I'm just going to sit here and stay with that. So as you hear teachers say, and you hear me say, and other teachers say when you're working on something, stay with it. And so it becomes this kind of cliche thing the teacher says, stay with it. Because the only way to unlock that prison, to find that key, is to experience it for yourself. So, you know, if we bring it back to the Carnation Revolution, it was not theoretical or conceptual what happened that day. You read about it now in books, but it happened. People lived that moment. So I say, some people in this room actually lived that moment. And some people weren't born, but they have heard from people who did what happened. And the only way to truly free yourself from what's oppressing you is, the key word is yourself. Only you can do it. So that's why we say you sit here and you look into, so whatever your question is, who am I? That's the big one. That's the best one. That's the absolutely best question, which will unlock the main gate. And then you go through the main gate and you will find that, yeah, you might have some other doors that are locked in there. But that main gate's wide open. And there's no going back once you've done that. Once you've opened the door to that prison, then the other, you might be in other little rooms that are locked, but this one, but you're out, right? And you see that you were never locked. You were never locked in, actually. You were always that, but you didn't realize it. So my Dharma name happens to be you are that. So if you ever ask me what my name is, I'll tell you you are that. And I'll tell you that even if you don't ask me my name. That's why my name is that. I just don't want to keep losing track here. Although I'm not really losing track because I'm talking about the same thing and I'm always talking about the same thing. So. If we come back to just the Buddha's story, so he sat here and he, or sat there, let's say, and he looked into and said, I'm going to sit here until I get to the bottom of this thing. And great determination, which is very important in our path too. Don't give up, you know. Like we say, you know, however your life is presenting at this moment, that is your path. You don't need to be on another path. So stay with it. Stay with what is your path. Stay with your question. How badly do you want to know? You know? How badly do you want to wake up? How badly do you want to be free? How much do you want? How much are you willing to let go of is also part of it, right? Because it actually does involve letting go of our attachment to what's so familiar. This, you know, huge cement block of our fixed ideas about self and other that is obscuring, is keeping us from seeing who we truly are. So the same mind that wakes up is the mind that's oppressing us, which sounds absolutely crazy, and it is. I mean, it is from the point of view of our thinking mind. From the point of view of our who we truly are, it's absolutely marvelous that we have this capacity to be completely deluded and to be completely awake. In fact, our true nature is that awakened nature. And yet we don't see it because we're caught up with this aspect of ourselves that is cloudy and dull and confused and reactive, aggressive, fearful, doubtful, all of these things that we have, that we're so caught up in. So we're actually then, we come here and we say, we're going to sit here for 3 days, 4 days, 3.5 days, say. And we are going to be rebels on this spiritual path. So we've come here for this revolution of the mind. We're resisting the status quo of this confusing, insane world that we live in, that is trying to convince us to buy, sell, become, be self-absorbed, everything we've said before. It's basically the status quo of suffering and confusion, right? And we're saying we refuse that. We're rebelling against that. And instead of going out to a picnic today or having parties or whatever, or going to the mall to do shopping, there's probably a lot of people in that mall today, right? Is it open? I don't know. Yeah, there's probably a lot of people in there, you know, shopping. This is a great, you know, all the years we've been coming here, this is great to have this shopping mall right over there. Great reminder. I look out my window and I see Continent every day, every hour of the day. At night it's lit up, you know. Great reminder. Actually, you know, a little side story, many years ago when we came here, I actually gave a conference at the FNAC in that forum, in that. There weren't very many people there, but there were a few rebels who were refusing the status quo at the FNAC in the forum. And there's nothing wrong with going to the mall and going to the cinema or shopping at Zara or, you know, filling up your caddy at Continent. There's nothing wrong with that at all. This is not a judgment call that I'm making. It's just that if we become confused and think that is the way, the path of realization of our lives, then we miss who we truly are and what the real, what we could call the real spiritual path of liberation. So we're, you know, we're like troublemakers here doing what we're doing here. And the Buddha was a troublemaker. He went against everything that the culture and the order, political and social order of his time. And he made everybody in the Sangha the same. And this is India, where there were, you know, strict caste system. He made everyone who came take off their clothing, whatever it was, and make robes of rags or just pieces of cloth that they could find, which is the, you know, the origin story of these things we wear. And yet, you know, like, so I have one with this beautiful brocade. People have different colors, they have different things, you know. But that's the origin of it. And there even, I even read an interpretation of, or a story, so the Buddha's first Dharma successor, according to the Zen legends, was Mayakashapa, who was a great rich merchant of some renown or something, and came to practice with the Buddha. And the Buddha said to him, okay, if you want to come and practice with us, let's change robes. Let's exchange robes. And Mayakashapa had this beautiful, you know, fancy brocade robe. And the Buddha had just this thing made of rags, right? And so Mayakashapa was a little reluctant, but said, okay, you know, he really respected and was really attracted to this teaching, and so he did it. Then there's the story at some point where the Buddha holds up a flower before the great assembly, and the only one who smiles is Mayakashapa. He got it. And we say this is the first transmission. Now, there is a version of the story that goes, then, after the Buddha had died, Mayakashapa said, well, the Buddha gave me his robe. So I'm special. And that has been passed down. When we receive transmission, we give the Buddha's robe. When actually the Buddha gave him his robe because he wanted Mayakashapa to give up his other robe, to give up his great, beautiful possession. Now there is truth to both versions of it. And when we do, you know, give the robe of the Buddha, it does symbolize that we're giving up all of our worldly goods and clothing. That's what happens when people become monks. They give up everything, their usual clothing, and they're supposed to be leaving home, giving up their possessions and their family life in the worldly world, and wearing the robe of the Buddha. In any case, whatever it is, so we're asked to, on this path of liberation, to let go, to give up. But the only thing absolutely that we need to give up, that we the only thing we need to let go of, that we need to leave, and I say this because I'm not from a monastic tradition. I'm a lay person, and I didn't take any monk's vows, put on any monk's robes, anything, like shave my head, do any of that. Because for me and for my teacher, it's so clear that the only thing we need to let go of is this identity and attachment to self. That's the leaving home. That's what we leave behind. That's what we let go of. That's what we say, I accept to not have anymore. This attachment to this identity of me, mine, I. That's a big one though, right? That's letting go of the status quo that we're accustomed to. The status quo, so there's this status quo in the bigger world, the cultural, the political status quo, economic status quo. We have rich people and we have poor people, and the rich people just keep getting richer and the poor people just keep getting richer. Less poor, unfortunately, they don't keep getting richer. But, you know, I was really surprised when we took a taxi from the Porto airport to the Compagnia station. I've done that a number of times. And when I first started coming to Portugal, probably for the first 10 or 15 years, that probably cost €7, that trip, less than €10. Yesterday it was €25, which is comparable to kind of what you would pay in Paris for a taxi for that kind of length. Stunning. And as we said with Lisa, okay, but many of the Portuguese people aren't benefiting from that and aren't able to keep up with that. If everybody was getting richer, you know, of course, then there's the fiction of that, then eternal growth, which we know is not true either, but... So this economic status quo, political status quo, cultural status quo, where, you know, we were talking last night about women and men and different positions and different... in the film world with Joanna and in the music world with Rory and, you know, there's different... all of these different statuses we have. In the Netherlands recently we talked about the book of the 7 points, wasn't it? Or the seven, maybe you weren't in that small group, seven check marks?
Yeah.
So seven boxes, right? There's a book, a popular book in the Netherlands where this guy said that basically the leaders of the country, isn't it? Or the top sphere of the country, all check these 7 boxes. And you can probably imagine what they are. What were they? It was like...
male, white, Protestant, blah, 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 above.
Higher education, family, or higher education. Right. Okay, here we go. But, you know, we could look at ourselves and we probably all check many of those boxes in this room. Maybe not all of them, but many of them. So these are just, you know, status quo that... that's the status quo. In the Buddhist world, so the Buddha said, okay, I'm going to not adhere to that status quo because I have woken up and I saw that that's all just fictive and that's what creates so much suffering. That's the root of our suffering, is all of these attachments and criteria and positions that we identify with. Number one, me. So... and he saw when he, you know, you say he saw the morning star. As I like to say, he says, you know, how wonderful everybody throughout, all beings throughout space and time have this same nature and are awakened simultaneously. Because they're not actually really asleep, they just don't know they're awake. So something like that. And we tend to think of him as being this exceptional being who realized this, and this is so great and beautiful, and he's like, oh, we venerate him. But actually what he was saying, what was so wonderful for him is he realized that he didn't see that before. And like I say, he realizes he's come late to the party. You know, the party's already been going on for ever and ever and ever, and he just realized it. But when he realized that, he realized that everybody was at that party. It's all one party, and we're all there. But we just don't realize it. So he realizes that. He realizes why we don't get it. And then that causes our suffering. And he realized how we could put an end to it, because he just did it. His own experience is what he then passed on. It's not the experience that he passed on, but he spoke from that experience, like I'm doing right now, or like we do about anything, you know? So last night at dinner, we're all having conversations. And each of us is speaking from our experience. So Joanna's speaking about her experience of the film world in Portugal, in the UK. Rory's talking about his experience in the music business. I don't know what I was talking about, but it was probably my experience, whatever it was. And when we talk from our experience, we're speaking from our heart. This is what we really know. Or this know is not even such a good word, but this is what we've experienced. It's true. It's not a fiction, what we're sharing. It's true, that's our experience. And no one can deny you your experience. That's what the Buddha's saying. He's saying, this is my experience. I see that we are all awake. I see that what causes us suffering is that we don't see we're awake. That we are attached to being a certain way, not dying, being healthy, being young. We are attached to all these concepts we have about how we think we should be. And that causes us great suffering. Because we don't truly see the impermanence, we don't truly see our true nature, which has nothing to do with any of this being young or old, being healthy or sick, being rich or poor. Nothing to do with any of that. He was a rebel. He was, you know, he revolted against, he was a revolutionary. He revolted against the status quo, and then whoever wanted to listen to him and join him in this path, this revolution of the mind, heart, he did it. He accepted them, whoever they were, however they looked, whatever level of society they came from, and he spoke to each of them where they were. He responded to each of them as they were. So, unfortunately, I should be speaking Portuguese to you because that's where we are, but I can't. So it's better that I do say something, even if it's not that, and meet you where you are here, you know? I try to, as we say in English, I try to read the room. I try to pay attention to who's here, who came, what we're doing. If I was doing a retreat in France today, I probably would not be talking about the Portuguese Revolution. I might, because we have so many Portuguese people in the Sangha. I might. If I was in France, I probably would be speaking English, speaking French. If we were online, it would be something different again. So it's really, we have to pay attention to the situation, the circumstances, the people, and respond to it. And the Buddha was a great teacher in that sense, because that's what he did. We even have koans, you know, the Buddha responding to a non-Buddhist, speaking to an old lady, speaking with a woman whose baby has died. He responds to everyone according to their circumstances and situation. Because each situation and circumstance is different, but the essence is the same. So we may not speak the same language, as I said, you know, we may live in different countries, have different histories, and yet our essence is the same. And the essence of this practice is the same no matter what. So, you know, we have all these different teachers and groups and rituals, schools. You know, so we have it all came from this one guy sitting under a tree and seeing a star at night. But and then we have Tibetan Buddhism, and we have Theravadan Buddhism, and we have Mahayana, and then we have Zen, and then we have Zen in Vietnam, and Zen in Korea, and Zen in China, and Zen in Japan, and Zen in America, and Zen in France, and then we have Tibetan in all those different places, and all this stuff, and all these different rituals and mantras and words, books, all of this stuff. It's really not about any of that. You know, the essence is what it's about. The very basic essence of who you truly are, your true nature, the true nature of being, the true nature of mind, heart. That's all it's about. And all of the teachers and the rituals and all that is there to help us realize that. But if we confuse the rituals with what the essence is and what the point is, then we become lost again. That's why, as you can see, I don't put a lot of emphasis on doing, you know, if it's perfect or not, and how we ring the bell and whatever. I put my experience is that there is an importance to rigor. It's important to be rigorous about it. Rigorous about your practice. Does everyone understand rigor in Portuguese? How would you say that? Yeah. How do you say it in Portuguese? No problems there then. It's like the dedication and the rigor. Not straying from it. So if we, you know, don't pass the condiments at the right, quote, moment, that's a reflection of us not really paying attention. But that's not bad. That's a great opportunity to say, oh yeah, I wasn't paying attention. I let the condiments sit there while I was eating.